Before we start, everyone at Allier Le Rouge was saddened to hear about the untimely death of Dave Johnson earlier on in the week. He signed for Liverpool in August 1976 and his last appearance was in March 1982. His medal honour, 4 league championships, 2 European Cups, 1 European Super Cup and 1 League Cup. A total of 213 games and he scored 78 goals and was an integral part of Bob Paisley's magnificent team. Our deepest sympathy goes to all his friends and family. God bless you, Davey. The Doc Johnson.
This is the Allier Le Rouge podcast on the Blood Red Channel, bringing you the view from the terraces at Liverpool FC.
In a very unusual season, a close season, a winter break that, you know, Jürgen Klopp's been asking for a while, but not under these circumstances, don't suppose. But I'm joined today by John Nicholson, regular guest, Simon Hughes from The Athletic, and Stephen Monaghan. Well, it's been, you know, Man United went up for sale this week, Simon. And also there was a couple of high-profile staff left the club. I mean, what's going on? I mean, a lot of people are on Twitter saying, oh, with these people leaving, Liverpool must have a buyer lined up. And is it as simple as that, or is it more complicated?
Well, I must confess, I've actually been off work this week. So... you probably should have phoned James Pearce.
He was on last week.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sort of trying to interpret things from afar because I have actually been trying to switch off a little bit from football this week. But then it always happens in the, you know, in the weeks where you're trying to relax that all hell breaks loose. So, yeah, obviously, first things, Man United being up for sale. I think that's a really interesting time. And obviously, with it becoming public that Liverpool are now available to buy. I saw the story in the Times earlier on today, you know, claims that it's going to sort of make Liverpool, the challenge of selling Liverpool that bit harder with Man United available. Man United are valued twice as big as Liverpool, which is a huge sum of money. I mean, £8 billion. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, £3 or 4 billion is incredible, obviously, but I just can't get my head around that. I think what Liverpool have as an advantage is that the stadium's pretty sorted, modernised now, whereas I think anybody buying Man United would have to think about that with Old Trafford. I think
they're buying a dump, aren't they, basically?
Yeah, a fair amount of work needs to happen there to bring it up to date. So you're not just incurring the cost of the purchase. And then, obviously, there's the issue with the team. But I think what the Glazers have proven, obviously, over a long period of time, is that a team doesn't need to be successful to generate a lot of cash, which allows the cycle of money to keep going. So, I mean, I suspect, going back to the Liverpool sale a few weeks ago, when that story was broken, I've spoken to a lot of people in the weeks afterwards, and the theme coming back is that it's more likely to be American investment or full takeover rather than other parts in the Middle East. I'm sure you've spoken about this in the past in the pub, but there's all sorts of reasons why the Middle East just doesn't quite stack up at the moment unless somebody comes, you know, from a position of total, you know, sort of obscurity to try and buy it. You've got Saudi Arabia already bought Newcastle. You'd have to be a brave man, I think, in Saudi Arabia to go up against the government. You've got Abu Dhabi with City. You've got Qatar with PSG. They'd have to sell a stake there. Bahrain, I don't think, has the capital to do it. And so it just leaves Dubai, which is a conversation Liverpool fans were having 15 years ago, wasn't it, with DIC? And from what I hear, there's not the appetite there as well. So,
do you think, Simon, do you think this is an inevitable consequence of the collapse of the European Super League? Because obviously it was Liverpool and Man United were the main players in getting that. Off the ground, wasn't it? Do you think it was inevitable this would happen, or?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do think it's inevitable. I think, John Henry and Joel Glazer are pretty close. That they work together more on the project big picture than the Super League, from what I've been told, John Henry didn't have a huge amount of involvement in the Super League, but obviously there were other people at Liverpool that did. And there's no doubt in my mind anyway that they haven't had conversations about, you know, sort of the lay of the land now. I think the Super League collapsing is sort of a major blow for them, in the sense that the value of the club, I don't think at this moment in time, is going to go much higher than it is. So they probably see it as a good opportunity to cash out and hopefully let somebody else have a go at trying to make the club competitive in the long term. I mean, they have been competitive for a long time now, Liverpool, let's be fair. But I think it reaches a point where, you know, the Manchester City aren't slowing down. Obviously, PSG aren't slowing down. You've got Newcastle coming up the road. I think they probably feel at this moment in time that it's a good time to look at what the options are. So, that's one thing that people haven't really sort of led in on, the sort of analysis pieces, that it's proof, really, that the Super League is dead, because otherwise, if it was alive, they would not be looking to sell right now.
Yeah. John, in terms of the timing of it, you know, it's very, I mean, is it a case of them sitting around the table going, well, you put Liverpool up for sale and we'll come in a couple of weeks later? Do you think, I mean, is it as simple as that? Or is it, you know, they must have had conversations, mustn't they, about, you know, about selling the club. And, Man United announcing this a couple of weeks after Liverpool, I don't think it's a coincidence, is it?
No, it probably isn't. And I think Simon's just told it as much, that, you know, Glazier and John Henry talk a lot. I think another factor is the FFP, really, because I think John Henry always thought that the FFP would be a set of rules that people would follow, and hence Liverpool could compete on a level playing field, if you like, against some of the other clubs. But it hasn't been the case. You know, Man City's proven that you don't have to comply with FFP. And if UEFA, or, well, who knows, RFA one day, but if UEFA challenge you on it, you can beat them in the courts anyway.
So
I think that's a factor as well.
Yeah.
In maybe John Henry's decision to, we've done what we can, really.
Yeah.
And when Newcastle comes along, it's just another team now to compete against on an unlevel playing field.
Well, we've been in this position before, where the club was up for sale and people were, you know, saying, oh, you know, DIC in 2007, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel, you know, as a long term fan, when, you know, this, you see all the nonsense on the internet and Twitter? How do you feel as a fan? Because the heart and soul of the club is now going, you know, to the highest bidder, isn't it? You know, basically.
Well, that's football in the future now, isn't it? That's what it's going to be like. You know, obviously we just see Man United fall by the wayside again. You know, following our footsteps to possibly sell the whole shebang, and as you said there, they've got a massive assignment. As you said, they're double what we are, apparently. Allegedly,
yeah,
but
yeah,
the infrastructure of all the ground and all around that, you know, there's another £1 billion again, you know, to get it up. Where does this going to end? You know, years ago when we had our new owners in Ix and Gillette, and, you know, we fought to get them out because, you know, we foreseen what was probably the future with them too. FSG steps in. You know, the arguments have to be good custodians, and is debatable on both sides, really. You know, the way they manage the club, you know, it's been good, hasn't it? You know, these took us
to compared to Hicks and Gillette, but it's not a very high line, is it?
You know? No, but what I mean, Pete, with, you know, they got out of jail really with Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what I'm trying to say. With them all, and then the way they perceive football is you sell to buy and you rotate the players, kind of thing, to get the money in the club. Now, once it all broke a few weeks ago, we all thought they've run its course now, because they can't compete. You know, let's be honest, they bought the club for what, 350 million, I think, whatever. Now to go and get Jude Bellingham, I just think he's popping up for the last like 2 years, and it's 100 million plus. So it's like a third what he paid for the club for one player.
Yeah.
So go and times that by four more players possibly to keep us at a level to challenge City and all the other teams around us. It's money that they haven't got or they wouldn't spend anyway. So.
Well, they never spend their own money, do they? It's all,
no, they never. But that's what I'm saying. That's the conundrum with having these owners. And that's what we say. It's both sides. You can look at it. That, yeah, they've been good, as in we've won a lot of trophies, but they got out of jail with Klopp. But if they never had Klopp...
Without Klopp, it
wouldn't have happened. And, you know, we all know the net spend on since Klopp's been here. But I think that's gone now because the players have aged. There's no sell-on clauses for it. If you would have sold Salah, which we all didn't want to happen, but we all didn't want to pay £500,000 as well, you know, because we all have a bit of morals about us. But is this the way football's going now? You know, it's a worrying time again. You know, we mentioned the Super League before.
Yeah.
I don't think that's dead in the water again, you know what I mean? But you know, look what's happening to Newcastle now. What if a country like that comes to Liverpool and Man United? And it's the battle of the top four then, isn't it? You know, Newcastle in that then. And who else is going to come in for a team like that? But if we got a new American owners, I think it's the same, more or less. So, but why would someone come in and pay £4 billion, allegedly, and go on and model what FSG has done? It wouldn't work, would it?
Le Rouge on the Blood Red Channel.
Well, it's open to debate. What I mean, people, these basically the hedge funds, aren't they? And they see it as an investment which will grow, and that's exactly what's happened to FSG, isn't it? You know, they were able to buy for 300 million, and it's worth at least 10 times, maybe more than that. Yeah.
So it's time for them to go and they'd be thinking, it's time to get out of, you know, let's go make our Zolle. Because how can we keep throwing? Well, they'd have to start throwing a lot of money into the club to keep up with cities. So they know listen, they're businessmen, they know.
We can't
keep up with City no more. You know, we've run our course, you know, and let's get out of here. Let's leave town.
Simon, there was a couple of high profile people left this week. I mean, it was sporting director Julian Ward. And also head of data,
Ian Graham,
wasn't it? Yeah, Ian Graham. So, I mean, was that significant, you think, or do you think that's, you know, a lot of people are speculating, if they've gone, there must be new owners in the pipeline, you know, and they didn't want to work for them or whatever, you know, or is it more complicated than that, do you think?
I think it is more complicated, yeah. I don't think it's necessarily related directly to new owners. I think big person at Liverpool over the last sort of 10 years, really, has been Mike Gordon. I'm sure you're obviously familiar with him. Based in Boston, he essentially runs the club from Boston day to day. Had a relationship with Michael Edwards. You know, he basically hung his hat on Michael Edwards before Julian Ward.
Yeah.
When Michael Edwards was basically, you know, a computer guy, you know, a number cruncher. You know, Mike Gordon, he spoke the language that Mike Gordon understood. Since then, obviously, Mike Gordon was key to getting Klopp in. You know, his relationship with Klopp's really strong. After 6-7 years working together, Michael Edwards decides to leave, which was, you know, a big decision in itself to walk out on Liverpool at that time. Julian Ward since replaced him. But since then, Mike Gordon's gradually stepping away, you know, with his responsibilities, and I believe that he's now central to the sale of the club, and the sort of the day-to-day running is now led by Billy Hogan. So,
you think it is then? It's a sale, not an appeal for investment.
Yeah, I mean, my interpretation again of it, just having a few texts going backwards and forwards with people today. Mentioned James before, I think he's going to write this. So you know, he thinks that it's central to Mike Gordon, the fact that he sort of was the mediator between the two. I mean, I know everybody loves Jurgen Klopp, but he's not easy to work for. And he's demanding. It's not for everybody, as has been proven, I would say, by the search for a new club doctor, which is still ongoing. I mean, when I say ongoing, I don't know whether anybody in the last week or the last couple of weeks has been away with work as well, whether that's changed, whether he managed to get somebody in the serving garden and leave. But if, you know, it hasn't been a straightforward process, put it that way, and Klopp is a very demanding person to work for, and it's not for everybody.
Yeah, sure, so, he is.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a touch of that here as well. I mean, to walk out on Liverpool barely 6 months into the job, pretty drastic decision that, I would say. And, you know, I mean, to some, he might be thinking, well, he might have an in, he might, I'd imagine Julian Ward's have a good working relationship with Mike Gordon. Mike Gordon's probably briefed him on what is going on, you know, from what I understand, there has been, you know, an offer on Liverpool, which is what has prompted, you know, all this, you know, what has happened since. So maybe Julian Ward's might think, well, it's best to go now before and push, sort of thing. And, you know, he can say, well, I've got Salah to sign a new contract. I got, you know, got Darwin Nunes through the door and one or two other contracts sorted out. So, but it's a big decision to make that because he's been at the club for a long time. I think 2013, 2014, something like that. He came to Liverpool as like sort of as a European scout, I think he was initially.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Worked his way up. So to leave the club in these circumstances, pretty surprising, really. So I think it's going to be interesting to see Liverpool go for. I suspect it'll be somebody led by Klopp, you know, if he's going to hang around, because ultimately, you know, he's got control of everything now, Jurgen Klopp, really. You know, he's, you know, as I said, you have to have a certain personality to work with him.
Yeah.
So I think we'll find that somebody who Jurgen Klopp is familiar with, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. He's got complete control, as the song goes. Yeah. John, are these departures pretty worrying, or you just think, you know, if they're leaving and Klopp's in control, Klopp will get the people he wants?
The whole thing with the possible sale and the departures is potentially worrying, yeah. You know, I think we said on the last podcast, you got to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
You know, we were almost taken out once with Ix and Gillette. The Glazers done to Man United what Ix and Gillette would have done to us, only Man United could sustain it because they were successful at the time and they had a big stadium.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want someone coming along taking us over and piling all the debt onto the club as Ix and Gillette did and the Glazers did, you know, and there's nothing to say that that won't happen. So, yeah, it is worrying, really. As long as Klopp's there, you know, as Mano was saying, you know, Klopp has been marvellous for us, really.
Well, he shaped the club in his image, hasn't he, really?
Yeah, you know. Yeah. But whether someone else could come along and do what Klopp's done, I don't know. But worrying, in answer to your question.
Yeah. Mono, I mean, in terms of, you know, when you see people resigning, you see the internet, you know, the Twitter goes into overdrive, doesn't it, saying, oh, you know, people leave and it's, you know, what's going on? I mean, how do you feel when you look at all that, you know?
Yeah, well, let me see that, you know, the other day. Like John said, I started worrying, you know, thinking again, you know, where's this leading to now? You know, first of all, the club are up for sale, and then two main players, you know, in the backroom staff have resigned. You know, is there something happening? Are we sold to someone? Then they're bringing their own people in. That's, you start thinking all that, and but you think of the relationship that the club or Klopp would have had with, you know, the two fellas would have been good, and let's ride the south. You know, the future's good with Liverpool, but with them just saying no, we're going, and it is worrying for us. And who is going to come in? As you know, we've all said, you know, Sam, you know, you know, a bit more than us, allegedly. And then we think, is it, you know, someone from Arabia again, you know, that is going to come in? But you just named, you know, if someone comes in, they can't, they'll have to get rid of another team, whether, you know, whatever country it is out there. And then, do we want to go down that route? But yeah, then what's the alternative? What is left there?
Well, that's what you hear people saying on the street, don't you? It's the way of the world. Money talks, you know. And
yeah, you know, but we've been mourning for how long, you know, against all this, you know, against the financial fair play, as John said before.
Yeah, you know,
City have got away with it, you know, for how long now? You know, would we like to go down that route? You know, Newcastle, as we keep saying, they're going to be uncommon in the years to come.
Yeah.
But it could be the death of football, couldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, with all this happening.
Speaking about the death of football, I mean, have you been watching the World Cup, Mono? I mean, it's hard to get into it. You know, I mean, it really. I mean, I watch the games where Liverpool players are in, but
yeah,
I've got no enthusiasm whatsoever for it, and it's not. You can just see it's almost like a computer game, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
fans who are over there aren't the real fans, are they? You know, no, and there's no traveling between cities because there are no cities. It's just all manufactured nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, but when you see the likes of Germany, who you know, they travel a lot, you know, supported the national team, and there was just a few thousand there, wasn't it? You know, by the way, you need a lot of money to go there for the start, never mind for a couple of days to see your team, but when you're going for like 2, 3, 4 weeks, it's a proper mortgage, you know. You've got to spend to go.
It's a credit card dropping.
Yep. So it's
unless of course you're paid for by the Qatari government.
Yeah, and walk around with, you know, a national team, you know, their kit on.
I could see you dressed as an Arab model, actually.
Well, it wasn't when we went there for the World Cup, but we were in and out. You know, it was doable, but this now it's manufactured. You can see it, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the games are boring. There's no atmosphere. There's a few, you know. I thought the Wales fans were great. You know, they made a bit of an atmosphere. But there hasn't been that many, has they? You know, the games haven't really lit up yet. One or two, you know.
The early stages of the World Cup are always like that.
Yeah, they're always like this, really. Yeah, because they're a bit cagey, they don't want to lose the game until like John, maybe the third game where they've got to have a go to get through.
Yeah. John, have you been watching the games?
I've seen a bit of all of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been quite happy with the new timekeeping. I'm looking forward to that coming to Anfield.
I thought you'd like that.
You know,
10 minutes, you know, 15 minutes.
We had the first 3 or 4 games of our season. We had goalkeepers going down with fake injuries after 2 minutes. I think the Palace keeper did it, and then Newcastle's keeper did it. And I know we got it back against Newcastle in the 7th minute of injury time or what have you. But yeah, looking forward to the half time board going up, and it's 10 minutes to half time, you know, and then 15 minutes at the end to make up for all the time wasting, because we see an awful lot of it at Anfield.
I think it'd stop Pickford going onto the floor, wouldn't it, if that happened.
I think it'd stop quite a few of them, if we started using a real clock. So I'm looking forward to that happening.
Yeah. But Simon, you wrote an absolutely brilliant article on this week in The Athletic about, you went over to Nepal a couple of months ago, was it?
It was last month, and wrote an article on
the migrant workers who built the stadium and built the infrastructure, really. And how did that come about, Simon? I mean, how did...
Well, I was, last summer, my boss phoned me, and my wife had just fallen pregnant. So he was saying to me, I want you to go to the World Cup and spend 4 weeks there. And I was like, I had to come clean, basically, and say, you know, basically, she's due to give birth. She's due to give birth in a couple of weeks' time, basically. So I didn't want to be at the World Cup while this was going on, naturally. So we spoke a little bit about all the possibilities and stuff that I could work on ahead of the World Cup. And his idea was go to Nepal and speak to the workers who've obviously spent, 20 years essentially building Qatar to this point. So, that was how it came about, really. So I spent, like, 8 days there traveling around the country with a guy who essentially worked as a fixer, but he was a journalist, and he's written a lot about human rights. So that was really helpful because he knew exactly what I was looking for and was able to point in the direction of the right people. And I met lots of people on the trip, and it was an incredible trip. Nepal's a beautiful country. I absolutely loved it there, but every interview was pretty harrowing, really. Everybody who spoke to had lost something, whether it be money, health, loved ones. It was pretty heavy. So, but I sort of look from afar with Qatar and sort of sympathise with the workers' situation and sort of, I suppose, gently tutted about what was going on and thought, well, you know, it shouldn't be happening there, but I'll probably watch the World Cup. But after I came back and having listened to people and looked them in the eye and sort of empathised with them and realising, you know, the people across the world are just the same as us four speaking here, you know, that they're all motivated by the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
Seeing people, you know, having to move away a long way from home, years at a time, not seeing the family at best, and then coming home with very little money, or obviously at worst, not coming home at all, and seeing, you know, whether it be little boys or girls growing up without a father. Like, I've got to be honest, like, I just think, I haven't watched any of the World Cup for that reason. I just think, you know, it'd be, I think I said to you the other day on text, that it would be a betrayal of what I've been told, really, because as far as I'm concerned, this World Cup shouldn't be happening in this country. Absolutely no problem with the World Cup happening in Qatar. But two bottom lines for me: pay people the right amount of money, because these workers haven't been paid well. That's the other thing, that a big sort of misunderstanding about Qatar and opportunities around work, that it gets said, well, the migrant workers actually getting paid better than they would be in their home country. That's not strictly true. They go to Qatar in lots of debt, and get paid pretty much what they'd be paid in their home country for the equivalent job, but they go because they don't have, because Qatar offers the opportunity of consistent pay, essentially. That's why they go, you know, monthly pay at best. So I just felt as though, you know, I find it hard to watch the World Cup knowing what's happened there. I think Qatar should have the World Cup, providing they pay people well and they treat people with respect, you know, and sort of a lot's been said about sort of over the last couple of days, well, the West haven't done this over a long period of time, but this doesn't help anybody's conversation. There's no accountability for anything. We'll just go around in circles, you know, about how do we advance the world, you know, like, I don't think a certain part of the world just gets a 300-year pass because, you know, parts of this world, I mean, that I must say, I sent a load of questions over to Qatar. They were quite cooperative ahead of the release of the piece. Yeah. That was sort of the prevailing mood. Like, so, well, you know, what about in England where the certain things happen? Well, believe it or not, mate, I actually agree. I think it's terrible what happens in England, you know, around employment laws and migrant workers and people who come here for asylum. But just because I'm from here, it doesn't mean that I actually agree with everything that happens here. There's that sort of silly conversation going on at the moment, which hasn't been helped by Infantino. Alain
Le Rouge on the Blood Red Channel.
What do you think, Simon, of, you know, fellow journalists being over there? And I mean, obviously the BBC they didn't show the opening ceremony, did they? And they had like a half an hour discussion about Qatar and whether it should have been there. But have you seen FIFA Uncovered? You know, because for example, the 1978 World Cup, you know, it was done by a military dictatorship, wasn't it, in Argentina? You know, there was no big outcry then, was there? You know,
well, Johan Cruyff didn't go, did he?
No, yeah.
so you know,
you're off an open goal there.
The best player in the world wasn't there, but
yeah, you're right.
I would argue that the media's changed since then a lot. You know, there's you know, the way things are reported has changed dramatically. There's a huge amount of media, a lot more media interest in everything that happens.
Yeah.
You know, I think that any journalist who goes there, I mean, at the end of the day, you can't say, well, I'm not going. You still have to report what's happening. You know, and as a journalist, I think a lot of the journalists I know that are being sent by The Athletic are doing stories around the human rights as well. And I think that that should continue beyond the World Cup. That's been a thing leveled at me saying, well, why didn't you do this a few years ago? You're just doing it now because of, you know, because you want to draw, you know, sort of draw attention to yourself. And I'm like, you know what? Like the last thing I actually want to do as a journalist is draw attention to myself because the amount of bullshit you've got to deal with sometimes. But, you know, the reason why I wrote about it was because of the good work of other journalists who have continued to write about it for a long period of time. That's where I think Jürgen Klopp got it wrong a few weeks ago when he sort of said that, you know, journalists haven't done enough. It's like, no, the only reason you're being asked the question is because of all that work. As a major person in the public eye, you know, he knows that his voice carries a lot further than most people. I guess now, you know, the point is, well, there's little can be achieved by it. Not all good journalism leads to change, unfortunately. We like to think that it does, but it doesn't. I still think that ultimately we should still keep talking about it. It's important to keep talking about it. And it's important for, as you know, a Western nation, for us to keep talking about, you know, sort of our historical contributions to the world No problem with that at all. But to just say, well, no, like Infantino the other day was an absolute disgrace as far as I'm concerned. With that statement, it's just like you're just playing to a gallery now who basically are the reason why you were still in power. And I just think that his words were absolutely appalling. I think it just gives a free pass to anybody who you know, sort of wants to host a World Cup and treat people whichever way they want to treat.
Look at the One Love armbands, and then the fact that, you know, a few teams got together and said, we're going to wear these, and then FIFA said, well, you'll get a yellow card, and they just backed down straight away. I mean, how does that make you feel? Or do you think, well, that's FIFA again, overstepping the mark, really, isn't it? Or, you know, and then the German team putting their hands against the mouths. I mean, it's tokenism at the end of the day, isn't it, if they're not going to carry it through?
Yeah, I think the FA have handled it appallingly, to be honest. I mean, my whole thing about the report that I worked on, I came away from it, not necessarily, obviously, I don't like a lot of the things that happen in Qatar, but my anger was directed at FIFA for you know, they have blood on their hands. It's their responsibility to ensure that a country is capable of hosting a World Cup in a safe manner. And that includes building the stadiums and then when people are there as well. So you can't just pass it off to you know, the tournament organizer. They have the right, they have the responsibility to ensure that everybody who goes there should have a safe working environment.
Yeah.
But the FA, you know, in this instance, the FA knew the rules beforehand. They knew that ultimately, if you want to make a protest, and I disagree with this agreement, this arrangement where it's not a protest, is it? You've got to basically apply to protest. It's like what's going on in this country at the moment now. You've got to apply to have an official protest. Well, it's not a protest then, is it? Now, the FA made promises to the LGBT community that they were able to do this, and they didn't. It seems to me it was just like a casual promise now. That they said, oh, yeah, we can do this. We're the FA. It's like, well, actually, when, you know, push came to shove, they shat the pants, basically, didn't they? And just went, yes, FIFA, we'll do whatever you want, FIFA. Now, I actually think the German, I know they lost, so that they lost to Japan, so the gesture that they made has probably been lost somewhere, the power of that. I actually think doing something like that was really good. You know, like the players have obviously spoken about it internally and agreed to do it sort of almost spontaneously in reaction. I think that's a much more powerful thing than just having, you know, the FA orchestrate this like token armbands. It's not really a protest if you've got to organize or have officials and organize it. I would say I think all players, for me, you're hearing a lot of players saying, well, we're not politicians, we're here because we have to be here. But they still have a voice that they're quick enough to recognize the power of their brands when they're signing deals for, you know, watches or trainers. So they know that their voice carries. So if they feel, all I'm saying is, if they feel really strongly about it, if they do genuinely feel strongly about it, speak about it. What's the problem?
Like Johan Cruyff did.
Exactly.
Is any player refused to go? Has any player refused to go? I don't know if there are.
No one has. The same thing. Well, it's not my choice to be here. It's like, well, if you do feel really strongly about it, I'd respect you far more. I mean, had Harry Kane or somebody else in the England squad railed against it, it would have been one of the most powerful things ever. So, in sport, I would say one of the most sort of outstanding thing in England's international has ever done, really. But instead, they've just all sort of towed the line. And I just think, if it makes me question whether they are really serious about any issues they sometimes speak about when it's, comfortable in front of club media and they're asking nice questions.
Yeah. John, do you think this is just overshadowing the whole tournament? I think it's going to get worse, isn't it? Because Neuer was saying that was just the first thing. Obviously they've had a lot of criticism in Germany for doing it because they got beat. If they'd have drawn or won, I don't think they would have had that criticism. But other people are going to make gestures, aren't they? I'm sure they are.
I don't know. I'm not so sure that the other people will make gestures. I know the Danish have threatened to do something, but I don't expect the RFA for 1 minute will stand up because, Simon mentioned that FIFA's got responsibility for safety for the workers, and they have, and for safety where they're putting on a competition. But UEFA's just put one on competition on in Paris.
Yeah.
3 months ago,
that
wasn't safe. And they'll argue, well, we haven't issued our report yet, but what's the report going to say? I don't think they're going to admit any responsibility, are they? And RFA will never challenge them because RFA won a tournament off UEFA. So RFA won't step out of line. They might argue, well, Germany can do that because Germany's had tournaments. They're not going to get one in the near future. But that's what it's all about. So I don't know whether protests will get anywhere. Maybe from the Germans it might, but from many of the others, will it? No. I don't think so. It's not going to happen.
Mono, is this like just a cloud over the tournament, or can you enjoy the matches without thinking about any of this?
Well, the ones I've been watching, every time they come on, all the pundits, they're all talking about it all the time, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not letting it go. It's not as if they're whitewashing it. Talking about it.
Did you see the advert for Saudi Arabia in half time the other night?
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of them, isn't it?
Destination. But then you're hearing, Messi's aligned with them, and then Argentina going to go for the World Cup in the future. So
that is absolutely bizarre. Isn't
so
it?
Where's the And I was been thinking about what John's saying there, about FIFA with UEFA. We've got our own, thing going on with them.
Yeah.
Which is going to be interesting to see the report when it comes out the end of this month, hopefully. But I don't really hold my breath with it all because FIFA have got away with it up to now. There's a lot of noise against them, but that was outrageous, what the president said last week at the start of it all. It was absolutely pathetic, and it's like, it's my ball. I'm going to do what I want.
Yeah.
And, even 2 days before, they've moved the game forward. So, the FIFA should be saying, no, you can't be doing that. It's like,
banning
the ground.
Banning drinks, yeah. I mean,
yeah, it's just on and on.
If it was only Budweiser, I'd quite welcome that.
You've seen, some Welsh ladies going in the ground with the bucket hats on because it's a rainbow colour. They're getting sick.
Yeah,
off. Where's all, you're all welcome. It's not happening, is it?
No.
I went there towards Liverpool and it was fine, I'll be honest with you. But we were only there for 2 days, and all what's gone on this time in the build-up to the World Cup is so different, We were aware, everyone was like, of aware what was happening, in the country. Mm-hmm. But FIFA, I watched that programme, Peter. It was outrageous. It's nothing that we didn't know anyway.
No, but
of what goes on. And that's what I was going to say about,
It was only because the FBI got involved, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't being for the FBI. who traced all those payments. You know, they would have all got away with it, wouldn't they? Yeah. They'd still all be in positions, wouldn't they?
Yeah. And it's, you know, but they still make the more or less the same decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable. And that's why I was going to mention UEFA, because it'll come back to all that, you know, again, you where's it going to stop? Where's it going to end? Where's all, you know, they say it's the football world. It's not the football world at all, you know, because they're not listening to the football world. It's like what Simon's been on, and, you know, and why didn't, you know, we talk about due diligence when we get owners.
Mm.
You know, where was their due diligence, you know, in Qatar all them years ago, 12 years ago, when, you know, he said, "Yeah, you know, we've done it. They're going to move on as a country, but that's their laws and their rules, you know." And
yeah, Simon, do you think, you know, Qatar being wants the World Cup, should want to open up to, you know, wants to open the country up to tourism and that type of thing? But do you think it's been a bit of a PR disaster for them at the end of the day?
I wonder whether in years to come they'll come to that conclusion. To be honest, I mean, you look at, suppose, Abu Dhabi, you know, various other parts of the Middle East that have invested in football. They've had heat, but not this heat, you know. I mean, the big thing is that where UEFA just, FIFA just fall totally flat in their arguments is when, you know, they talk about football and providing opportunities for countries to develop through football. Well, Qatar's already said, you know, that it's basically going to dismantle the stadiums and send them to other parts of the world. So it's not going to, this tournament's not going to benefit Qatar as a football nation at all.
They've got 14 football teams, haven't they?
Exactly. Yeah. The average attendance is a couple of hundred. So it's not being a decision that's been made for football.
No.
So when you hear Infantino and various other people from FIFA saying keep politics out of football, well, you've fallen for them because they made a decision, Qatar, to go for the World Cup, which has nothing to do with football. It's all about creating more awareness of, essentially, you know, their brands and giving them credibility across the world as a major player. It's got absolutely nothing to do with football.
Yeah,
so, to be fair, if they're trying to convince themselves they're failing, because they haven't convinced me, you can understand it. There's previous places where they've had, they had a World Cup in Russia, and look what's happened in, you know, with Russia recently. Yeah. But you can almost make an argument that Russia is a football country, isn't it? It's got, it does have a passion for football. There is an argument to say that it could have led potentially to some sort of football development in that country. Hey ho, you know, 4 years later, Russia are banned from the World Cup. You know, so these big ideas that FIFA have about, you know, changing the world through football, is the humility in this? It's like football, I think football can only change things when it's organic, really, not when it's organized, and particularly when it's not based around money. And even being honest, I just think it's a total lie. It's all down to money. You know, in a few years' time, these stadiums in Qatar that, you know, thousands of people have died working on will be white elephants if they have elsewhere anyway. So
not much has changed since the Roman Empire, has it, really, if you think about it?
Well, that would be Qatar's argument, I guess.
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Allez les Rouges on the Blood Red Channel.
And that's what basically they were saying, wasn't it? You know, what about human rights around the world, and what about colonialism and that? But, you know, it gets into... It's what about it all the time, isn't it?
You know, it's just there's a lack of responsibility, and it gets FIFA off totally. As I said, my issue really, I mean, I don't like a lot of things that happen in Qatar, but FIFA, you know, to claim they think that the overlords of the world, the masses of the world, who can change everything. Football is a powerful sport, and it can change stuff, but the way they're doing it is not changing it. They're just greasing their own palms and looking after themselves, and the only empires they're building are their own. And unfortunately, Infantino has proven the last couple of certainly the last week or so with some of the things that he said, is that he is no different to any of the other ones that have gone before him. And for things to change in football, it has to come from FIFA, from within. That documentary that you mentioned just shows just how, what a murky organization it is. And the people in charge at the moment, without reform, football's only going in one direction, sadly, I think. It needs a major, major overhaul. Who those people are to lead that change, I'm not entirely sure. But Yeah, I just came away from Nepal just feeling like really like sort of, you know, I used to look forward to the World Cup when I was a kid. Absolutely, yeah. Wasn't really invested in it emotionally, and it was quite a nice tournament to watch because you weren't that emotionally connected with it.
Just right, yeah.
As you said, the different cities and everything else. This is just all very sterile, very choreographed, not done for football reasons, and I just can't say.
I just can't wait for our season to start again, so you can start enjoying football again. I mean, I would highly recommend listeners to read that article by Simon. It is absolutely brilliant, absolutely harrowing, though, some of the cases that went on, you know, when it brings names and brings it to a human level, really. No, but before we finish, just like to, there's something else happened with Shaqiri. Did you see Shaqiri's interview where he said that he had a beautiful 3 years at Liverpool? We won many titles, Champions League, we won the World, the Club World Cup, won the Premier League. It was a wonderful time. Liverpool will always stay on my heart. It was a great tribute, wasn't it, to his time here?
I haven't actually seen the interview, Peter, but you know, I think most players end up come saying something very similar. Like, so there is something about the football club that you know, players do
take
love
to the heart, and
absorb, you know, and you know, whether it's players you've gone like Shaqiri or even like some of the newer players now. I mean, Nunes seems to be going that way.
Moral, do you hope Jude Bellingham will be saying similar things in a few years' time? I mean, that performance, that's one of the few games I watched. I mean, I watched the Wales game and I watched the Uruguay game. I mean, I watched Wales because I just their World Cup song was one of the greatest things I've ever heard. You know, it's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? I watched the England game to have a look at, you know, Jude Bellingham, really, you know.
As I said, Pete, before, you know, everyone's been raving about it for the last couple of years, is 18 months or so, and social media is awash with Jude Bellingham this, Jude Bellingham that, and we said before on it, you know, hey, if Jude comes, you know, we'd welcome him, you know, but it's the amount of
money. We've got a good song for him, haven't we?
Well, you know, it's the amount of money. We go back to what we said about FSG, you know, they're not going to pay that, you know, they're not going to pay that, their own money, are they? So we got no one to go and sell now, really. Let's go and sell one of our best players again, like as in Salah again, but he's just out of contract, he's not going to go. So, you know, we're trying to build a team, you know, dismantle it now. So it's a different, you know, we'll go back to jumping the gun here a bit again. But I think it's, as you said before, FSG, I think they've run the course, haven't they? You know, with the buying and selling of players. So if someone comes in to go and and buys them, like, at that price, I just don't know how they're going to do it, you know what I mean? If that's why, whether they sell the whole club or they just get investments. But, yeah. You know, why are people just going to come in and give you 100 million plus or half a billion to say, yeah, go spend that on players, but where's our investment back? You know, I don't know. I just don't get it. You know, the money side of it, you know, they're going to walk away with 3-4 billion quid in profit, aren't they? You know, but who comes in then? And who buys Jude Bellingham for us? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Simon, you know, obviously, don't think you're going to watch, you're not going to watch any of the World Cup, but I mean, you might watch the final, might you?
Once I finish my week off, I will be back in work mode. So if I'm asked to work, I will have to work. But hopefully it'll give the opportunity to follow up on a couple of things that I learned in Nepal and just, I suppose, report on it from afar. But I've just got no appetite for the actual football, I've got to be honest. It's just not something that feels right to me. But it's a shame because I think obviously there's been one or two shocks already, hasn't there? And games, quite a few nil-nils as well. But
Shocks happen when you're playing behind closed doors, as we know years ago. And these are, you know, you can just tell by the crowds are like, you know, it's a rented crowd, isn't it? Basically, that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Simon, I admire your stance on it, mate, you know, because it really must have got you going to Nepal. You know, hearing the stories about, like, you know, the workers and you know, sort of the families and everything. You know, you're a football fella. We all know you. You know, you love our team, and you know, you love football. And for you, you know, to have a stance like that, like it must have really got you, I think.
Oh, thanks, Mono. Yeah, well, it did. Yeah, it did. I mean, I went there. Like everyone in England is the same. We're quite removed from it. I think there's a lot of sympathy for the workers, isn't it? But it's only when I was fortunate enough, and I suppose unfortunate enough to go and actually
meet. Yeah.
So it's when you see them and you realise, you know, they might live in the countryside in Nepal, you know, sort of many, many thousands of miles away. But people fundamentally across the world are motivated by the same things, you know, trying to get some sort of work and, you know, supply for your family, basically. Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
And now Qatar said they said there was only a handful of workers died, but, you know.
Well, I met three. They said three is the official figure, and I met three who had sadly passed away in Qatar. So I must have met all the ones who died, which
the families, yeah.
Yeah, the families, yeah. So yeah. I mean, I met lots of different people from sort of different strands of
you know. Amnesty International said 6,500, did they?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The thing is, a lot of people come home with serious illness as well because of the conditions they've been subjected to over a long period of time. I met a guy who went to Nepal in 2002 went to Qatar in 2002 before Qatar had won the right to host the World Cup. And, you know, his sort of thing was that a lot of the work that he'd done had helped set Qatar up to a point where they could almost convince people in FIFA and say, look, this is what we've done, you know, already in the country. We've built this infrastructure out of nothing. He worked there for 7 years and had to return home with illness. And it was only when he got home that he found out that he had kidney failure. And he's still alive now, but he's got to have dialysis treatments twice a week. You know, he didn't look well. I mean,
that's through working in the heat, is it?
In the heat, yeah. Just working in 50-degree heating. In boiler suits, essentially, you know, working in a ditch with very little oxygen, you know, and not being given much water. I mean, it's inhumane, some of the treatment that certainly 10, 15 years ago that the workers were being subjected to. More recently, there have been reforms that have improved some things, and there's allegedly been a ban on work throughout the summer. But unfortunately, I was told that, you know, that there were people who still were made to work in the summer heat when the temperature can get to like 52, 55 degrees, which is just insane. You know, it's this constant life of like sort of living in your camp, your bunk beds, you know, getting on a bus and getting to the building site, going back home, doing the same, going back to the camp, just repeat with very little time off. I mean, it's appalling, really, and it really opened my eyes. I mean, I knew that all this happened, but just when you see people in the actual... the devastation of the loss on families, it's probably not reported enough that just the basics of like, you know, of losing your husband and not having somebody around to look after your kids. It was just like that sort of thing. I think it's very easy to sort of present people as statistics, really, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you think when you see the slogan, like, football is life, then?
I think it's bullshit. Total bullshit. Yeah, it's just total bullshit. I mean, I think everything the FIFA try and promote now, like, for me is lost. Without reform, you know, this will just carry on. As I said, I think Infantino thinks of himself as one of the most powerful people in the world. I think the people that run FIFA have huge influence over politicians and massive businessmen, massively influential people, as we've seen. You know, I do think that, I mean, one thing I'd like to do more of after this World Cup is look more at FIFA and try and really figure out what's going on there. There's a lot of people who do really successfully, but as we've discussed already, you know, Liverpool fans have been on the rough ends of treatment from UEFA.
Yeah.
And it's all part of the same tree, really, just a slightly different branch.
Yeah.
You know, I think until there's major reform where people are actually thinking about people first rather than money, this is just going to carry on.
Thanks a lot, Simon. That's, you know, absolutely very powerful stuff, you know. And Ali LaRouge, we usually, you know, talk about football, but I think we have to talk about this. It's very important. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks to John Nicholson, Simon Hughes and Stephen Monaghan. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the greatest game in the world, isn't it? And it's just exploited for the wrong reasons in some quarters. But I think everyone, genuine football fans, have all got something thinking, this isn't quite right, what's going on here. This isn't quite right. And I can't wait for the Premier League to start again. Then the first match is against City, isn't it, Mono?
Well, tickets are on sale on Monday, so that's...
In the Carabao?
Matches.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm looking forward to. And also, you know, I'll be looking at some of the Liverpool players over in the World Cup, but everything else leaves a pretty sour taste. You've been listening to Ali LaRouge. I hope we haven't depressed you too much. And, you know, some of you can enjoy the football. But we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time. And you never know, Liverpool might have new owners.
You've been listening to the Ali LaRouge podcast on the Blood Red Channel.